You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I thought that today, since we are in a period of great unusualness in the book world, a period during which Thomas Pynchon finds himself on the bestseller list after 17 years of virtual silence, I thought it was important for Bookworm to salute him. That writing created the consciousness of a generation, say the post-Kesey Ginsberg generation is the Pynchon generation. And thinking of the many cliches that have surrounded Pynchon's work from the very beginning, critical adjectives that almost always get used, I decided I would make a list of what people say about Thomas Pynchon. They call him encyclopedic, crazed, obsessed, Byzantine, itself a Pynchon word, slapstick. And I was thinking, well, what do I do with this Pynchon show? How do I go ahead? And I thought of calling a friend of mine who's a friend for 20 years, who's been editing for the last 10 years a journal called Pynchon Notes. He's one of the prime Pynchon watchers in America, and I thought I'd have him on, John Kraft, co-editor of Pynchon Notes. Are you there, John?
Yes. Hello, Michael.
Hi. Have I forgotten any of the adjectives?
One of the obvious ones that comes to mind is paranoid, itself a Pynchon word.
Itself a Pynchon word, the Pynchon word, probably.
Oh, you could use tamer-sounding ones like, you said, encyclopedic, erudite, historical, experimental.
Has black humor gone bye-bye?
I think so, though you sometimes still see it. I was wondering what we'd call this generation. It's not the Pynchon generation anymore to a lot of readers and writers, is it? Is it the Carver generation?
Yes, I would say there was, after Pynchon, say, a Barthelme generation, after that an Ann Beatty generation, and then, yes, a Carver generation, and, say, a whole school of fish of minimalists now, Bobby Ann Mason and let's just say et al.
Yeah.
How did Pynchon Notes start?
My original co-editor, Kaciuk Tulolian, there are three of us now, organized three special sessions at annual Modern Language Association conventions in the mid-70s, and he developed a lot of contacts that way. I happened to be one of them. And he would write to people on a list he kept occasionally to let them know what was going on among Pynchon people. And in one of his occasional letters, he suggested that he might try to get into the habit of every 3 months or so sending out a list that contained everything he had heard of that people were doing, a list of work in progress, circulating manuscripts, projects planned.
Tell me.
Just to keep everyone who was interested in Pynchon well informed.
Did you guys ever think of yourself as being like one of Pynchon's sinister organization of dark others, a sort of literary Tristero, perhaps?
No, I don't think so. At first, I thought you were going to ask if maybe we felt by existing as, explicators, as a kind of institution, that we were flying in the face of the impulse of Pynchon's fiction.
Which is?
Iconoclastic. There's an adjective.
There's an adjective.
Revolutionary.
Uh-huh.
Subversive.
Uh-huh.
Naysaying.
Uh-huh. Yes, the good old team of naysayers, how badly we missed them.
Yes.
I was thinking, what I know in these 17 years there have been speculations of what Pynchon has been up to. They used to say a book on Mothra. They used to say a walk across America on the Mason-Dixon line. And then Vineland came as a late surprise to many Pynchon watchers. You know, you kind of heard it across America. Vineland.
Yes.
Was it a surprise, this book?
Well, rumors persist, of course. And I sense that people think there must be people out there who know. The problem is one never knows whether one is hearing from such a person or not. But I'm hearing that this isn't the big book. This isn't the one that had been rumored for, oh, at least 12 of those 17 years, if not more, maybe more like 15 of those, that there's a big book still in the works, and that this is testing the waters, perhaps. He has been out of the public eye, as if he was ever in it, but he's been not front page news for a long time until just recently. Maybe testing the waters, maybe a kind of sport. There's a rumor that his friends were getting on him about not being politically engaged enough, and that this is his answer to that criticism. This is his political novel.
I thought when I was reading it that just as a few years back there were cartoon books called Marx for Beginners and Freud for Beginners, that Vineland in a way is Pynchon for Beginners, for this generation, not of naysayers, but yaysayers, that this book was written to edge a hardened generation ever so gently, nudge, nudge, nudge to the left. Would you please be human, please? This anonymous Pynchon stays, even with this book, anonymous despite the trained binoculars of every imaginable multiplied media. What do you suppose allows him to stay secret, and how does your group regard itself in the light of his desired anonymity?
Well, I wince at your using the phrase "my group," for what we do. I think we're a community of scholars, and I hope we aren't infringing on Pynchon's personal life or desire for privacy. I am interested in his works and not in his person. He's made it more or less clear that he doesn't want me to be interested in his person, and I've never made any attempt to get close to him as a person. I've lived, say within 20 miles of where he grew up, and I've never gone near his boyhood home or schools or tried to contact any of his friends, simply because that's not what he wants, and that's not what I, as a scholar, if that's not too presumptuous, am interested in.
People who read Vineland and consume it in one great gulp may want something else while waiting for the big banquet of whatever the great big book might be. In the meantime, some snacks. How about giving an address for would-be subscribers to Pynchon Notes?
All right. Our newest editor is Bernard Duyfheisen, who is handling subscriptions now. That name is spelled Duyfheisen. He's in the English department at the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire, in, of all places, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. 54702.
Eau Claire, could you spell that?
EAUCLAIRE.
Well, that's the address for new and long-standing Pynchonomanes. In the meantime, John, you haven't answered my question. How has he managed to withstand the constant searches for Pynchon? How has he managed to retain his anonymity?
I think people who come to know his work or to know even a little bit about him, come to respect his desire for privacy. I'm sure there are ways that a determined person could track him down. I don't want to give anyone ideas, so I won't say the obvious, but clearly, for instance, his friends are very loyal to him. I'm sure any number of people could have, if they'd wished, sold their story and sold him out, but they just won't do it. So he must inspire, as I say, a great deal of personal loyalty and even love, and people respect him and help him keep a low profile.
I've been speaking to John Kraft, co-editor of Pynchon Notes, on the occasion of Vineland appearing in America and appearing on the bestseller list. Thank goodness there are readers out there still. Stay tuned for John LaRue in the second portion of Bookworm. My second guest today is John LaRue, who has just had a book published, a book of short stories called Comedians from Viking. You know, what I knew about you before I read the book was that you had been the fiction editor of The Atlantic, is it?
Yes.
And as much as I like that magazine, I had expected a certain kind of respectable and staid story. And, you know, Comedians is the name of the book, and I thought these would be about, you know, the small comedies of daily life and the finite methods we have of settling. But instead, these are stories of enormously unsettling and perturbing events. You say you don't find them gloomy stories. Why is that?
I'm glad these aren't respectable stories. And I guess I don't think they're grim. Let's be honest, they are grim, but no more grim than life itself. What I try to do, I think, what I try to do in a short story is to isolate a moment, or a series of moments, but in some of these, which are very short, a single moment at which a possibility of a choice, a moral choice, is made for us, and is made by us, and after that choice is made, our lives are never again the same. It happens that many of the choices made in these stories are less disinterested, less generous, less selfless than they might be, and as a consequence, I guess, the result is grimness. But I see much of life as terribly grim. I'm an optimist for everybody else and for life in general. I think things do finally turn out well. It's just in my own life that I expect death and destruction at every corner. And I've just been lucky up until now. The next corner might be it.
The young stand-up comedian in the title story, Comedians, is pregnant, and one day she begins to hear a new kind of music. She hears her unborn child singing in her womb. No one else hears it. It's kind of a Walkman sensibility, and it deters her thoughts of aborting the child. The issue seems to be about a miracle and the attempt to abort a miracle, as if daily life were a renewed determination to avoid miracles. There's a kind of interest here, both in miracle and in catastrophe, that seems religious.
Yes.
And at one point, Flannery O'Connor, responding to a letter from John Hawkes, says to him, "Your idea of the devil seems to be mine of God." In these stories, too, very fierce things happen, atrocities, that seem to be brought about from a divine, or at any rate, an angry outside force. Why is that godlike?
Oh, this is a real problem. My wife, who like me is a Catholic and unlike me goes to Mass every morning, feels that we have different gods, that mine is not only an ironic but rather a mean god. I don't see him that way. I don't see God that way at all. I do think when I always, among my friends, speak about God, if there is a God, but I think there is a God. But I do think that he tends to interfere in our lives and that we resist it at every point possible, and that sometimes, especially if we're, and I'm thinking of characters now, especially if we're talented or bright or brilliant or smug, he has to go to extraordinary lengths to get our attention. And it isn't that he's trying to ruin our lives. He's simply trying to remind us that we are not the still point of the universe. Which is how I think of him. And so when, for instance, in a story that ends very positively, like The Comedian, she's afflicted with this fetus who itself is quite charming and funny and who sings not only plain chant but golden oldies, rock and roll, and so forth. It may be that since she's a comedian, the only way the arch comedian can get her attention is by violating her sense that everything finally can be lived with by being made a subject of humor. And this alone can't be, and so she has to face something beyond herself. In other stories, it's quite true that, for instance, in that long novella, there are two principal characters, the sculptor and the sculptor's wife, and the sculptor has innumerable opportunities, through his wife particularly, to become aware of something other, larger, better, more important than himself, and consistently, he's a very ugly person, consistently, but a very brilliantly talented one, consistently rejects these opportunities. His wife, who opts for something quite different, leaves him, plunges into sex and another, any number of variety of experiments, but finally gives in to love. It happens to begin with physical love, but it turns out to be something divine. And reluctantly, unwillingly, she marches off to a kind of sanctity that is bleak, but full and whole and enriching. And her salvation is, despite him, his also, I think. If maybe I'm sounding too self-important myself.
Well, I have a question relating to that. You teach fiction at Stanford, is it?
I teach dramatic literature and I teach fiction writing. Mm-hmm.
And among the many artist narrators and heroes and portrait sitters in these stories, there are teachers of art. The sculptor is one of them. There is a writing teacher who regrets what he considers to be a minor gift, and there is a kind of ongoing despair at being put to teaching something that may, in fact, be unteachable. In other words, there seems to be an ongoing small caviling with the life you've been given.
I think you're absolutely right about my fiction, that many of these people who are, it happens in this book, not in any of my other books, but in this book, everybody is some kind of artist, all the characters, the main characters. But it's quite true that in this book, many of the people who are teaching art, whether it's sculpting or painting or writing or music, are themselves not the artist they would like to be. It's their great cross to bear that they know what great art is and can love it but can't do it, can't perform it. But I don't regard myself as any of my characters. I think I'm sublimely lucky to be teaching anywhere, but especially to be teaching at Stanford. If, for instance, I were to win the lottery tomorrow, not very likely since I don't buy lottery tickets, but if I were, I certainly would keep on teaching.
It's been a long career, but one that seems to have been, what would it be, revitalized with the publication of the last novel, A Woman Run Mad?
That's right. Uh-huh.
Was there a concurrent change in the tone of the writing at that point?
Yes. I'm amazed at what you... We've never talked before, what you seem to know about me. Indeed, I've published 12 and privately in collector's editions two other books, so 14 books, and I've never had... I've always had, thank heavens, nice reviews, and I've been reviewed in the New York Times each book, and they've said nice things. But I've never sold any copies, and I don't think anybody in America has ever heard of me beyond a few people in New York publishing. But in fact, with A Woman Run Mad... which was a novel I published a couple of years ago, I took on a story that I had told students about for 10 years. Why don't you write something since you want to write exciting stuff? Why don't you write about this woman who fell in love with this guy who jilted her, and she was a socialite in England, in fact, it was, and she was the daughter of a peer, and did this terrible thing. She seduced him one last time to her house, got him drunk, let him fall asleep, slept by him all night long, and then shot him. And having done that, what do you say, cut up, did some damage to his body, his dead body. And I told people this, and I said, what a story. And, of course, they never wrote it, and asked, why don't you? And I said, well, I don't write that kind of thing. It wouldn't interest me. If I wrote it, I would ruin it, of course, because I would begin after the murder and wonder what happens to such a person. First of all, how do they ever get that way that they could do such a thing? And then finally, how do you live with having done something like this? And then a friend of mine, Tom McNeil, who's a wonderful writer, who appears occasionally in Playboy and will have a book coming out in a year, said to me, well, why don't you ruin it and do it as a psychological study? And as a lark, to see if I could do this sort of thing, I began it and then got deeply into it when I discovered a what people think is a very unsavory character, but is my idea of a saint called Angelo, and finished the book. And indeed, it did change my life quite considerably, because Viking bought it and sold a lot of copies, and it sold to paperback, and it sold to the movies, and I made enough to have trouble paying my taxes this year. And since then, can I talk a little bit more? Because something nice just happened to me.
What's that?
It sounds vain. I've written a new novel, a very long novel, that'll be coming out in January of next year, called An Honorable Profession. And it's about a high school teacher who is accused of molesting a student. Really, it's a study in guilt, 300 varieties of guilt, because he isn't guilty of molesting the student, but he is guilty of plenty other things. And which of us accused unjustly isn't aware that we could be accused justly of many, many things? Well, Viking likes it a whole lot, and they've done this wonderful thing for me. They're going to bring out that new novel in hardback and paperback, and another novel that I've written that took me 6 years, which has no plot and therefore isn't commercial, I'm afraid, called Lies. And they're going to do that in hardback and paperback, and they're going to do this Comedians in paperback, and they're going to produce all my past novels and short stories in paperback. So I'm going to have 10 books coming out.
My goodness, all next year.
That is a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. I feel lucky to have caught on with the last book, so that there won't be quite as much catching up to do.
Well, forgive me if that's too long. I'm sorry.
No, quite all right. Nothing to even ask forgiveness about. I'm talking to Jean Leroux, author of the book of short stories, Comedians, just recently published by Viking. The first person unstable, there often is, even if the person is not literally mad who's narrating the story, there's a kind of madness in the story itself, a kind of condition under which the story could not be told, like the narrator of the final story who speaks in the seconds before her death.
Yes.
And is rather collected as she does so.
Yes.
What I found exciting in these stories is the feeling of a discomposure, of things falling apart, rendered by the person who is falling apart, but rendered in a very composed and quiet way. It's quite eerie. How did you come to that tone of voice?
I've always believed that if you're going to do anything bizarre in fiction, by gosh, you better be firmly grounded in every single other thing in that story. For example, you can write a novel about two Siamese twins who marry two other Siamese twins and then write the rest of the novel. But you can't write a novel about two Siamese twins who go through life and eventually have a lot of adventures and eventually at the end of the novel meet two other Siamese twins and marry. It strains credulity. But if you begin, if the given is in itself a violation of reason, it's supra-rational, the reader may or may not accept it, but he will accept it. She will accept it, I think, if everything else is absolutely nailed down to the floor. And I guess quite unconsciously I aim at doing that in everything I write. There's a little story in here about a boy who's going to grow up to be an artist, but who's thinking always of killing himself. He's an outsider. He's a very talented young artist. And there's a moment in which he's going into school, and he takes off his hat and his coat, and he hangs them up. And then he looks in both directions, and then he hangs up his face. And, I mean, it's outrageous.
Muti,
yeah. And I suppose, really, if a student handed me that story, I'd say, it's a wonderful idea, but do you really want to do this? Maybe you shouldn't do it. But I thought I would try it, and nobody seems to have objected to it yet.
It seems, perhaps, like you are Alice wandering not into Wonderland, but into Grand Guignol.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the new part of your fiction, that kind of disturbed or surrealist, distorted view, still guided by a moral schema, but nevertheless beyond the normal?
Well, I sincerely hope it isn't. I mean that truly. I do allow myself a lot more freedom with the bizarre, the surreal, the supra-rational in short stories, because you can control it more in a 20-page space. And you can get away with more because people will indulge you for 20 pages than I would do in a novel. Grand Guignol really upset me when Peter Prescott used to describe. He said it's Grand Guignol for grown-ups in a woman wrote that in Newsweek. And then I realized he's right. Of course it is. When you've got this bloodshed and these crazy people, of course it's Grand Guignol. But the next two novels that I've got coming out are have no such scenes
Petite
at all.
Guignol.
I hope. Now, there's some very mean people who know how to be mean to other people in ghastly ways, but I don't think I'll ever give in again to doing a castration scene or anything like that.
I've been talking to Jean Leroux, author of Comedians, a collection of short stories just published by Viking, and it's been a pleasure to have you down here from Stanford.
Thank you.
I hope you'll come back.
I'd love to.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ices, go in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books. Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.